Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails with Jen and Vanessa.
Please be advised, the following episode is for mature audiences only. We talk about content that may be triggering to some individuals and contain discussions regarding rape, murder, sex, suicide, religious organizations, and disturbing situations.
Now, let's get into this week's episode.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode
of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails. I'm your host, Vanessa.
And I'm Jen. Hey. And we're finally back after a long hiatus.
Guess who's back?
Back again.
I feel like we keep doing this and we're really sorry, but we have full-time jobs. But now during the summer, we're going to be more proactive about this.
We're
going to
prioritize this. We're prioritizing you.
We are, because we love you.
Yeah. So. And it's been crazy. I turned 30 and then I moved downtown. So it's been like very, very crazy. So now we're back.
Yep. And it's been great. We're recording from her downtown apartment right now.
Woo!
Feel very fancy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yes.
All right. So are you ready to get back into it?
Let's do it.
Okay. Have you ever heard of the group Budafeld?
No.
Okay. Budafeld, some people call it Budafield, is a group that was made in the 80s. If you guys have ever seen the documentary Holy Hell, that's on Netflix and on Amazon Prime, that discusses Budafeld.
I have not seen that. How old is that?
It was made in 2016.
Okay.
But it's amazing. It's okay. A great documentary. I highly suggest it to anyone that watches documentaries.
We love documentaries here.
Oh my gosh, they're the best. Mm-hmm. So it was a group started in the 1980s in Hollywood, California. And in the 80s, it was a time period where people were really looking for spiritualism. They were trying to be found, trying to find themselves, and just really want something more. People that joined the group, they said that it was the same thing. They were looking for something more, and a lot of them were pulled in by their friends. So their friends would meet someone in the group, and then they'd automatically fall in love with it, and then just keep recruiting more and more people.
I mean, that's usually how they all start anyway.
You always recruit off your friends. They said that when they were in the group, they felt like their soul was being fed and that they were loved and they were fulfilled. They finally had a purpose in their life. They said they stayed because they found a family and that they were very close to all of the members. So let's get into the group and how it was each week.
It really doesn't sound bad so far.
No, living on a commune with all my best friends and being happy and feeling fulfilled, like sign me up.
Yeah,
I'm down for it.
Exactly.
So a lot of people said that this was a hippie group. They had weekly meetings, which they called Satsay. Their leader was named Michelle Rostand, but it was a guy. His name was Michelle. He was born as Jaime Gomez, but then he changed his name to Michelle.
That's a big jump.
I know. You go from Jaime and then you go to Michelle, which I know is a man and a woman's name. And it's like interchangeable, but still.
Right. It's just a large jump.
Right. And he changed his name when he decided to go to be an actor.
Oh, okay.
So I guess maybe Michelle Rostand thought, I mean, it kind of sounds like an actor's name, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, shoot, Beyonce, Madonna.
That's like, true. Everyone changes their name.
I know.
So he was the master of this group, and he said that he was going to be the one that would be able to lead them to a great spiritual awakening. Everyone described him as very, very playful. He was extremely smart. The guy spoke 4 or 5 different languages. He was artistic. He was super into dance, amazing at ballet, which that's kind of hard to find for a lot of men, especially in the 80s.
Yeah.
And he was that type of person that had so many great things and different types of interests. He was the person that everyone wanted to be, like very well-rounded.
Okay.
He was also known for wearing Speedos, like all the time, which back then I think Speedos were pretty popular, I would assume.
I think they were, yeah. It was kind of like the norm for bathing suits for men, I think.
Yeah, so that was his MO. He loved Speedos, wore them all the time. He would make people in this group go to cleansings. Those were therapy sessions where he did hypnotic therapy on them. So he was a hypnotist as well. He was an actor and a hypnotist. This guy's like into everything.
He's the jack of all trades.
So he would do weekly sessions where every single person would have to be hypnotized by him. So just keep that in the back of your mind for later.
All right.
Like we said earlier, all the members, they spent all their time together. They lived together in a big house. They would usually have like 8 to 9 people in a house, and everyone supported everyone. So everyone had outside jobs. But if they needed to build something, everyone would chip in with their own money and build whatever they needed for their little community. They would live very clean, so there was no alcohol. They would exercise all of the time, and they paid all of their own bills, rent, etc.
So this was like a very good-looking group. They probably had great skin.
All of these people are beautiful. You should check out the documentary.
Uh-huh.
I was even like, I'll go there for a couple months and then come back and be like, hey, look at me now.
As you're eating sour cream and onion chips on the couch, you're like, oh, man.
Right. So yeah, like we said, they were all very close. Everyone is, you know, very happy-go-lucky. They would do things called service, which they were required to do. It was just doing nice acts for people. Like if they found someone in the community that wasn't part of their community, like part of the outside community that needed anything, they would go do it. People talked about helping veterans, like volunteering with them a couple hours a day and so forth. And they'd be like, I feel so good after doing that. And it's all because Michelle wants us to. Well, no matter what, if you go do acts of service for people, you're going to feel good about yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of religions do that.
And that's kind of surprising that they were, I guess, quote unquote, allowed to go outside of the community and help people. Because usually, like, you're only allowed, like, within your cult to help people.
Right. So this is still the 80s. So it's at the very, very beginning of it. So we're still in the very beginning part of this.
Okay.
This group. So another belief that they had, or another practice they had, was called Shakti. And Shakti was the transfer of energy from the master to the disciple or believer. You could see this in the documentary. It's very weird. He would, like, place his hand on people, and you could see them, you know, like, closing their eyes and, like, almost convulsing. Like, they felt, like, an energy through them. And when people were interviewed later, they said that when he touched them, they felt no longer like they were themselves. They felt a current, and, like, they could see light sometimes going through them. It was almost like an LSD trip.
I feel like this is not good. I feel like some kind of shock was actually being put through them. Like, I don't like this.
So as these people are living together and, you know, having these weekly sessions and these transfer of energy sessions, they were still seeking enlightenment. A lot of these people practiced yoga all the time, and they thought that if they stayed with Michelle, Michelle would show them the way to enlightenment. So then their first session of the knowing, which is what Michelle called it, mm-hmm. he would tell people if they were going to truly experience God. So you would walk into his little like room. He had his chair that almost looked like a throne, and he would set it up anywhere he went. So you would walk into wherever he was, and he would tell you, yes, you'll be able to experience God and know God, or no, you will not. So the people that didn't get to experience God, of course, they were super depressed, and a lot of them, it was at random. Some people would be brand new, and they'd be able to experience God. Other people would have given, like, 5 years of their life to the community, and he'd be like, no, you need to wait a little bit longer.
How would he judge who gets to experience God and who doesn't get to experience God?
He never explained it. He just knew because he's the master.
Okay, so basically eeny, meeny, miny, mo here.
Right, yeah, he gets to pick whoever.
Okay.
People said, again, that when they were told that they could experience God, it was almost like an acid trip for 3 days. There was all these like lights everywhere. They felt like they were, you know, super happy all the time and almost giddy. And they show scenes in the documentary where people were, you know, in the knowing part, mm-hmm. and they looked like they were on drugs. It's crazy how giddy they were and everything. So like we said earlier, Michelle used to be an actor in his previous life before he had this group. He hired somebody to take videos of the group all the time. He would have to do like offside projects. Like he did a music video once and a couple short films to kind of promote the group, which were very interesting. He was obsessed with working out. This guy worked out all of the time, and he always had to have members of the group massage him. So people would be there. That would be their job. They'd be on call 24/7. If Michelle called you, you'd have to go and massage him.
And he would just, like, pick random people from the group, like, come and massage me?
Yep, but he had, like, a close circle. So part of the close circle, they were the people that would massage him all the time.
All right.
Yeah. He would practice ballet, like, all the time. Each member had to practice ballet at least 1 to 2 hours a day.
When do these people sleep? If you're working out all the time, you're dancing all the time, like, did he have, like, a sleep policy, like, 8 hours of sleep?
Nope, not at all.
Wow.
Yeah, but then again, if you think about it, you're working, you're doing service, and you're pretty much just spending all the time with your friends. You're not talking to your family anymore. Yeah. You know, this is your community now. So right. I guess they just found time elsewhere to do that. So now in the 90s, they're still doing ballet all the time. they would have productions that they would do once a year, and they would only do them in front of their own group.
Okay, so now we're cutting off, like, the outside world.
We're still in the outside world. Like, people are still going to their jobs and everything.
Okay.
He's just, like, heightening it. So now people are having to do ballet even more.
Okay.
And practice even more and spend more time with him. He made a rule that everyone was to abstain from sex.
Oh. Why was that out of left field? Like,
in the 90s, that's just what he said. He said, okay, there's no sex anymore. You are not allowed to have relationships, like boyfriend-girlfriend or boyfriend-boyfriend or girlfriend-girlfriend. Like, you can only be platonic.
Wow.
Yeah. He said that the reason behind that was because their energy needed to rise with meditation instead of with sex. So if you, you know, have sex, you're depleting your energy. But if you're meditating,
I mean,
you're
kinda,
increasing your energy.
You're making it better, though. So... Oh, I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
People started having sex in secret because you have all of these really, really attractive people hanging out all day. You're not really doing anything else.
Oh, so, I found my train. So weren't there like families in this cult?
So, nope. So there was no children. It's only men and women. And everyone's like in their 20s.
Okay. Yeah, that's not going to work out. Everybody in their 20s getting it on.
Right. And he's still having these weekly meetings with everyone where he's kind of almost preaching. For example, in one of his sessions, he said, if you can't stand naked in front of your master, then you can't stand naked in front of God.
Why would you want to stand naked in front of God?
So he was saying it almost as in like, if he was comparing it to people always thinking too much. So if you're meditating, you're supposed to be clearing your mind and you're supposed to be not thinking and obsessed with all these different thoughts. At least this is from a believer. I don't know how he got this, but he said that if you have all these thoughts and you're not focusing on clearing your mind in front of Michelle, then you're not going to be able to do it in front of God and reach enlightenment.
All right.
I don't know how those connect at all, but that's what they were saying in the documentary. And I was like, great, Alan. That's amazing.
I'm trying to put dot one to dot two to dot seven. Like, I'm lost, but all right.
Yeah. And he still made people do these cleansing sessions where he would hypnotize them once a week. And now he starts charging them. So now they have to pay $50 once a week to go to these sessions. And every time they go to these sessions, they have to relive all of their worst traumas. So they would tell him all of their secrets, their thoughts, their fears. This guy knew everything about every single person in this group.
Man, talk about inflation on that.
I know, right? Yeah, that was back then. I can't even imagine now what that would be.
Be $5,000 per session today.
Right. So now people are reliving all their past traumas and everything. So he's telling them to get over your past traumas. We're going to give you a new name. So every single person in the group got a new name so they could detach from their past, even more detached from their family, no communication with the outside world. So he's starting to close in on the group and everything. And then in 1991, the Cult Awareness Network was made known of Buddha Field. And the Cult Awareness Network, I had never heard of them, and I'm going to do a story on them later. But apparently, they would go into cults and pretty much just like free everyone and then help put them in, you know, programs where they could be deprogrammed from brainwashing.
Are they still around today? Do we know?
I don't know. Okay. I'll have to look at that when we do our episode on them. But yeah, so Cult Awareness Network, they remain known in Buddha Field. Michelle starts freaking out. He grabbed three of his closest people in the middle of the night, and he's like, we have to leave now, and we have to find a new place for everyone to live. They start traveling, going all over the United States, and eventually they settled on Austin, Texas.
That's okay.
Yeah, I don't know why you would go from California to Texas, but...
I feel like that would be the... like one of the most conspicuous spots. Like I would go to like Montana.
Right. Yeah. Or Idaho. Like no one's going to find us there.
No.
Yeah. Or he moves his three people in the middle of the night. They go to Austin, Texas. And then eventually he sends word to everyone to go move there. So people sell their homes, they quit their jobs, and everyone relocates to Austin, Texas. They started doing yoga more and more to help recruit new members. And then in 1993, Waco happens, which we'll talk about later. But if anyone doesn't know what happened with Waco, pretty much it was this religious group in Texas. They got in a disagreement with the government, and it's kind of an accident, kind of not. But pretty much everyone died in the cult besides like two or three people.
That's horrific. But.
Yeah. So Waco happens. This makes Michelle even more paranoid and even more freak out. They would do exercises in case the FBI captured them. They would be taught not to tell secrets about the cult and just to pretty much say, like, I don't know anything. In 1997, they built a theater for all these ballet performances that they were doing. He did all the own choreography himself.
And again, he would make them practice even more hours a day. The men would have to do it. The girls would have to do it. All of the men were interviewed, and some of them hated it. And some of them were like, no, actually, like, really, really liked it. And then they would rehearse the same show over and over again for an entire year. And again, just do it for themselves. Nobody in the audience whatsoever. They would fly in costumes and stage props and everything. They spent a ton of money on this.
That is insane. You can't even perform for anybody. You're just practicing over and over again.
But if you think about it, a lot of cult leaders, I feel like they want to make all of their members tired. So what else is a better way to do that than make everyone dance for hours and hours and hours a day?
That's very true.
You know what I mean? You want to make them tired so then they're delirious and they follow every single thing that you say.
Yeah. You don't have enough energy to fight back.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, like, if somebody, like, really wanted to do, like, hip-hop, and he's like, no, we're doing ballet today. Again.
We only do ballet, okay? So he would give spiritual guidance to everyone, even more so than he did in the past. And then he started being more controlling on telling people how to live their lives. So he would tell people, you can't be friends with this person. You can't talk to this person that's in the group. He starts becoming more controlling. He also tells the members that they can't read books, watch TV. And one girl even bought a little dog, and he made her give the dog away.
Oh, that's just cruel.
Yeah. So you literally had to ask him permission for every single thing.
So now there are children allowed in the cult now?
Nope.
Oh, did you say little girl?
Oh, sorry. Like, it was a 20-year-old.
Oh. We're 30, okay?
We're 30, so now I'm so old and wise. Yeah. So she tried to have a puppy. He said, no, you can't have a dog. He started becoming older. This has been 10 years since this cult's been going on. So he starts becoming obsessed with plastic surgery.
Oh, no.
But instead of getting plastic surgery himself first, he would make members of the group get plastic surgery. So he would know if the doctors did a good job, if it looked okay, what the procedure was like.
What a
And then
D-bag.
He would have it done afterwards.
What a D-bag.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that insane?
That's insane.
He wore makeup all of the time, and he was known for always having eyeliner on and mascara, which is great. If guys want to do makeup, great. This guy looked awesome in it, honestly. But
yeah, no shame against it. I mean, shame against making people be plastic surgery rabbits, but...
Right. But at least for the most part, you can tell that he is super obsessed with his appearance. And I think the reason, too, that he became so obsessed with controlling everybody was part because he was losing his youth. Almost.
That makes sense.
You know what I mean? I just see a correlation with it. He would tell everyone you need to drop your mind if they were like having thoughts that were, you know, like maybe this group isn't great anymore. Maybe I should get out. It'd be like, you know what? You just need to drop your mind. Like, don't have outside thoughts. Just continue to meditate so you can lose all of those worries.
I feel like those worries want to go away with a simple meditation session.
Right. So now let's go to the 2000s. In the 2000s, the group's still going strong. Some people would leave every once in a while, and once they left, they were told, you're not allowed to communicate with them. They were dead to us, just like they do in Scientology.
Okay.
He would threaten people if they thought about leaving the group, and he would tell them that if they left the group, they would get sick or die within a year.
Hmm.
And it worked. I mean, a lot of people would stay because they think this guy is a messenger of God, so of course they don't want to leave.
Yeah, and you can't, like, talk to anybody that's on the outside that has left, so you don't know if they've gotten sick or not.
Exactly. He started becoming more manipulative, and again, let's think about those cleansing sessions, where he would have the sessions once a week with everybody and do hypnotherapy on them. He was using that to control them, control their fears, control their desires, all of that. I've never been hypnotized.
Do you think that he actually like put them under hypnosis?
Oh, everyone said yes. They said he was great at it.
Oh my gosh.
So
I would never want to do that.
Me either.
That's so scary.
In 2005, it started changing to be focused more all about him instead of finding, you know, like nirvana or enlightenment. In 2006, a lot of rumors came out that he was forcing men into sexual relationships.
Okay.
So when the men came out, they said that it would start in private therapy sessions when he was doing this hypnosis. And then from there, he would be like, let's talk about if you had any fantasies. And they're like, okay, well, I had this fantasy about, you know, Sasha that I live in my house with. He'd be like, let's talk about male fantasies.
Oh.
So then he would make them explore their male fantasies. Then he would make them take off their clothes in front of him and say, like, you can't be attached to fear, you know, things like that. And they were like, okay, this guy's like working on my spiritual self, right? Then it would turn even more sexual. And
you can elaborate in your mind from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the men that were interviewed, they said they didn't want to be in these relationships. He would tell them that he was having sex for them and that he was saving their lives and that they could take this to like a God experience.
I have no words.
And the horrible thing was, is there was one guy that was interviewed and he said that he would be raped every single time he went to a therapy session.
He was being raped. Yeah.
And he had to pay for it. So he was paying.
Oh my God.
To be raped every single week.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So more and more men start opening up about the abuse because the women had no idea. And it wasn't every single male that was abused, but it was a large portion of them.
Yeah, probably the majority.
Mm-hmm. And so this started to create, you know, a lot of waves in the group. People started doubting him. He would tell certain people to fake they have cancer so he could perform healings.
Okay, this guy is a piece of shit. Like, yeah. I mean, he already was, but...
Yeah, and then people started confronting him about all these things that were happening. He kept denying everything. Finally, people start leaving en masse. He did another knowing session, like he did in the first, and we talked about in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the only session he did. So he did another one to try to keep members there. Didn't help. So more and more people start leaving. He asked one of the members to find someone that could take out the people that were speaking against him to murder them.
Like, literally take them out.
Take them out. Yeah, so he's getting even more and more paranoid.
He's starting to sound like a Manson.
I know, right?
Like, seriously.
So finally, more and more people eventually confronted him, and they said, look, we promise we will not go to the authorities as long as you promise to relocate and quit, you know, having people or connecting with people and ruining their lives.
And quit raping people.
Yeah. So that's what he did. They relocated him to Hawaii. He changed his name to Andreas.
Okay, these large jumps.
I know.
Like,
right?
I can't.
I mean, Hawaii at least is better than Texas.
I know, but like Michelle to Andreas?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yep. They said that they started hearing disturbing things from friends on the island like
Shocking.
A couple years later, that he was not laying low, as he promised he would, and he was collecting new acolytes and actually calling himself Reja, which means God King.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. So he's still recruiting people to
no.
these days. Yeah. A lot of it's through yoga studios. And yeah, so he's still chilling in Hawaii. A lot of ex-members, though, that have gotten out, they stated that they were in it for about 20 to 25 years, depending on, you know, who it was. And it was just horrific to hear their stories because they said that once they left, they realized they didn't have any money. And they didn't have any savings because they gave all of their money to this group and they had issues adjusting back to real life. So one of the guys, Alan, who did this documentary, which I think everyone should watch, when the documentary came out, Andreas, at least now Andreas, or Michelle, whatever one you want to call him, or Jaime, he had people go to the theater that were in his new group to threaten them to shut up.
Okay, so he threatens them to shut up, but did they not go to the authorities? Or, I mean, they went on this documentary, so why is he not arrested?
That's a great question. There haven't been any charges pressed against him.
Well, can they press charge against him?
I don't know. I mean,
like, is it a statute of limitations? I don't know a lot about law, but...
I would assume that there is, and that's why they're not doing it.
Oh, my
but,
gosh.
Yeah.
They need to get with these Hawaii people to...
No.
Oh, my gosh.
But, like, these people are still probably brainwashed. They're in the Hawaii group.
Yeah. And how old is he now?
He's probably in his 50s is what I would assume.
Because, I mean, this group
Everyone in this
started.
Group was, like, 50, so yeah. They're probably around the same age.
So he probably had to start this, I mean, the 80s, so that's 40 years ago. I mean, so he's got to be in his
60s. At least 50 or 60.
He's got to be in his 60s.
Yeah.
Wow. That's horrific.
So that's Buddhafield.
I hate that. Thank you for sharing that.
I hate that. Thank you.
I hate it. Thanks. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to look him up real quick. Yeah, he looks like he feels like he's God. He's very about himself. We'll just put it that way.
Which, like, in the 80s, he would be a very attractive man. You know what I mean? Like, if he was, like, Ted Bundy and said, get in my car, I'd be like, okay, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, still... I just can't believe that everyone got to the point where they did with this guy.
I can't believe that either. Also, Jen had to remind me to pick up the microphone and speak into it. I just want to point that out because I was like, oh, this is cool. She's like, pick up the mic, you idiot.
The thing they never explained too, like the chakra and all of these, like all of these situations where they said they felt transfers of energy, that was never explained. A lot of people linked it to hypnotism and just the, you know, if one person acts like they feel something, a lot of other people are going to be like, oh yeah, I feel that way too.
Yeah. It's kind of, I feel like it's kind of like those 4 a.m. like church commercials where they're like, oh, Jesus has taken over you. You can walk again.
Right.
And they're like, oh, they can walk again. I'm going to be able to walk again. And then they do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the power of the mind, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But wow, that's, I hated that. And I hate that. I hate that it's still going on. And yeah. I hate that there's no charges.
I mean, they don't even have a website. If you type in Buddhafield into Google, there's one that's in Europe.
Yeah.
But they like are off the practices of Buddha and it looks like something completely different. They do service and stuff, but that's in a lot of religions.
Yeah.
But I tried to find him and I couldn't find him on Facebook or anything like that.
He's probably so secretive now because he knows, like,
I would too. I mean, because I'm sure those people still watch him.
Yeah.
I would if I was in that group.
If any lawyers listen to this podcast, write to us and let us know, please. Oh, all right. Well, I'm ready to move on from this.
So what are we drinking?
So this week's cocktail is called a limoncello cocktail or a limoncello lemon drop, I guess. It's summertime. It's nice outside. And, you know, I just wanted to get the summer vibe going. This cocktail is also yellow, which I'll explain that, I guess, in a bit. I don't know. But it's 2 ounces of limoncello, 1 ounce of vodka, 1/2 ounce of fresh squeezed lemon juice, which we did not have any. So you can use it from the bottle. It's fine. And then you're going to want to line the rim with sugar. So just get a little bit of lemon juice and sugar and lime that rim. And then you're going to put in a shaker, shake all that stuff together, pour it in. Don't pour the ice in. And you have a nice little cocktail.
It's really good.
It's a little strong, but it's good. We're here for it.
It's a good Sunday fun day.
It is a good Sunday fun day. Yes. All right. So are you ready to hear my story?
Let's hear it.
Okay. Why I said yellow is we're going to be talking about somebody named Happy Face.
The Happy Face Killer?
Oh my God, you've heard of him?
Yes!
Okay.
But it's been one where it's like all of them, and I say it's been one where it's so long, and yeah. I listen to so many different true crime podcasts that right. I don't really remember it.
Right. It's been a hot minute.
It's been a very hot minute.
Okay. So we'll get into this one. So we are traveling to the beautiful state of Oregon for episode 19. Now, I've never personally been to Oregon. Have you?
Nope.
Okay. But it's...
I played Oregon Trail.
Oh, I love that.
When I was a kid.
I always died in that.
I always died too.
Oh my gosh. But from the pictures and postcards, it looks like it's full of valleys and hills and waterfalls. The specific place in Oregon that I'm taking you to is actually the place that you see on a lot of the postcards. It's like a poster child. It's in Corbett, which is a small town of about 3,300 people. It's got this beautiful area called the Columbia Gorge, and it actually brings in a lot of tourists. So just imagine like your perfect hiking trail, like waterfalls, birds chirping, everything like that. So the Columbia Gorge also has a huge tourist attraction called the Vista House. It's a museum that also serves as a memorial to the Oregon pioneers and as a comfort station for travelers on the historic Columbia River.
Aww.
So fun little fact. So on the morning of January 22nd, 1990, a college student from a local university was riding her bike. She enjoyed the outdoors and decided to leave a little early and take the scenic route to class that day. She was riding through the gorge area, and she was about 1/2 mile away from the Vista House. She's looking around, appreciating nature while riding, when she comes to a complete halt. She knew what it looked like, but it couldn't be. Why would there be an arm sticking up from some dead leaves?
Oh, gosh.
I know. This brave lady gets off of her bike, puts her kickstand up, and walks close to the body to confirm that it was, in fact, an arm. She sprints back to her bike, and her adrenaline is pumping so high, and she takes a 10-minute bike ride to the police station, which, I mean, it probably was like a 20-minute, but she was just like, go, go, go. And the police come, and they see the body. The body had been strangled and beaten to death. A ligature was tied around her neck. Her face was so brutalized that the medical examiner couldn't tell if it was a male or female at first or what race.
Oh my gosh.
It was overkill. Her pants were down around her ankles. She had a patch of her clothes missing, and more specifically, like her zipper area and the button on her zipper that was missing, and she had vaginal trauma. Since they did not immediately know who this was, they made a report saying that an unidentified woman between the ages of 18 to 25 with dark brown hair and brown eyes was found, and she was about 5'5" tall. And honestly, nobody came forward. No one said that they were missing anyone. The police take the next logical step, and they make a sketch of the victim, and they release it to the paper. Still, nothing. It wasn't until Michelle's White's neighbor came up to her one day and said, "Hey, so Tanya's like home, right? Like, have you seen her?" And Michelle responds, "No, she hasn't been around for a few days, but it's not like she's missing or anything. This girl, like, goes wherever she wants all the time." And the neighbor says, "Well, there's a sketch in the paper today, and, you know, it kind of looked like her. And I don't think she actually had the paper on her, but the neighbor said, the neighbor told her to watch the news that night, and Michelle was thinking, I'm not going to watch the news. It's not her."
Right.
But curiosity kills the cat. When the 6 o'clock news comes on that night, she tunes into the segment about the missing girl. Again, the sketch appears and relief overflows her. It doesn't look like her little sister at all. But then her heart drops to her stomach. The news pans to the next segment, and it's the victim's clothing. And it was Tanya's jacket. She wore this jacket all the time.
Oh, no.
So she knew it was her. Tanya Bennett was a 23-year-old bookworm and music junkie. She was beautiful. She had long, dark brown hair and a charming smile. She was always reading and listening to her Walkman, mostly anything sung by Madonna, which I think is so precious.
Yep.
And she's just a free spirit. She was the only one in her family to graduate high school, and I don't know if she was a student at a college or not, but her family, friends, and community claimed that Tanya was a little intellectually disabled.
Okay.
So there was apparently a situation at birth where she was briefly cut off from oxygen. So she was, like, super friendly, never met a stranger, but she was naive and impulsive.
Mm-hmm.
So she lived with her mom. On the previous Sunday morning, Tanya was walking out the door with her Walkman, of course, listening to Madonna. Nothing uncommon there. Her mom asked her where she was going, and she said to meet my friend. That's all she said.
Okay.
So Tanya didn't drive a car, or she didn't have a car. I'm not sure which one, but whatever the case, she took the bus wherever she went. And her mom points out, "Okay, well, you realize that the bus only runs like once an hour on Sundays, right?" And she's like, "Mom, I'm 23 years old. I'm going to go meet my friend." And she's like, "Okay, well, just take the movie rentals back on the way." Which, how much do you love that?
Yep. I remember those days.
My mom would always, like, use me. I feel like that's the only reason I got my license, honestly, for a while.
Right. Go to Family Video or Blockbuster and return the videos.
You're going to pay the $4 fee if you don't take these movies back. So, unfortunately, that was the last time that her mom would ever see her. Apparently, she took the bus to a local pub called B&I Tavern, and this was around 1 p.m. when she arrived. She was somewhat of a regular there, and the bartender recalls her dropping in for a few drinks, playing pool with a couple of guys, which, spoiler alert, they were cleared of this case. She actually asked the bartender if she wanted to go disco dancing with her and her new friends.
Disco dancing.
Disco all dancing. Right. I love it. But she was like, "No, like, you just met these people. Don't be stupid." And she said, "Okay." So she left by herself, and nothing was out of the ordinary. Officers also visited other local bars that she would visit, and it turned up nothing. So it was kind of a bit of a dead end. Officers set up a Crime Stoppers line, which, fun fact, the first Crime Stoppers ever was formed in Albuquerque in 1976.
Huh.
You know, it went back that far?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's crazy. So thousands and thousands of tips roll in, but one tip stuck out in particular. The caller said, "I shouldn't be telling you this. He's been mouthing off about some girl. I can't protect him anymore. He said that him and this guy did it. They took her up to Vista and they strangled her to death." Pretty clear cut, right?
Right.
So this call ended up being from Laverne Pavlinek. So officers pay Laverne a visit. When they knock on her door, they said that she was the typical grandma. She was 57 years old. She had gray hair. She had those large tortoiseshell glasses.
I love it.
I know, with a calm, welcoming demeanor. I mean, she literally had a fresh pot of coffee and offered the officer some when they came in. They're like, "Oh, grandma, I love you."
Right.
So they're already getting the good grandma vibe. And once everyone sits down and gets comfortable, she starts spilling the tea. She says that her boyfriend, John Shashnovek, I'm sorry if I don't say that right, who is 18 years younger than her, was talking about how him and his buddy had strangled Tanya. She said that he was paranoid every single night and was heavily drinking.
You need a new boyfriend.
Baby, I'm telling you. So officers bring him in for questioning, and honestly, he comes in and he doesn't say anything incriminating, so they let him go. Laverne calls again. "Hey, so I found this note that really looks weird, and I think you guys should come over and see it. So again, they come over, and the note says, T. Bennett, good piece. So like a good piece of what? Like good piece of ass?
Like, I don't like that.
What do you mean good piece?
Mm-hmm. I don't like that at all.
So they bring him in for questioning a second time. He said he didn't write the note, and really, they couldn't prove that he did. It was just a random note. So again, they let him go. Laverne calls again.
Go, Laverne.
Hey, so I found this random purse and patch of clothing in the trunk of my car. I think it's the missing zipper that you guys had said on the news. So officers come out to see what she's talking about. They asked Tanya's mom if she recognizes the purse, and she said, no, that's not Tanya's purse. And then they sent the patch of clothing off to the lab to test and see if it matched Tanya's. And when the material came back from the lab, they said it was not a match.
So is she just trying to set up her boyfriend?
Yeah. So officers are like, okay, what the heck is happening here? Like, what's going on? So it turns out, like you said, this is not the first time that Laverne has tried to pin a crime on John. Apparently, a few months prior, she called the police and told them that he was involved in an armed bank robbery, and the FBI investigated into it, and John was, like, literally at work when the robbery happened, so he was cleared.
They need to arrest her for, like, obstruction of justice.
Right, exactly. So she broke down, and she said, look, he beats me, he's awful to me, I want him gone. And they say, Laverne, we are sorry you're in this situation, but, like, file domestic charges on him, get a restraining order. You cannot keep calling in and saying that he did something that he did not do. And she said, he did do it. And they basically say, goodbye, Laverne. A few days later, Laverne calls again. Okay. I was involved in the murder, too. I was trying not to get involved, but John needs to be in prison. I'll take you to where we dumped the body to prove it.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. So they basically say, all right, this is your last chance. Like, don't call again. So Laverne and the officers hop in the car together, and they take off down a country road. All of a sudden, Laverne says, we've gone too far. Turn around. So they do like a little U-turn, and Laverne stops the vehicle at the exact location that the body was dumped. She gets out of the car and like points to it and says, here it is, right here. This is where we drug her body into the woods.
Oh, okay.
And there's like this famous photo of her pointing at the woods, and we'll post it on our Instagram. But John and Laverne are both arrested on that very same day. And, you know, Laverne's story even changes a couple of times while being questioned. But the final story was that Laverne was strangling Tanya with a rope as John raped her and kept strangling tighter and tighter until she thinks she killed her.
And how old is Laverne again? This lady's...
She's 57.
Okay, so she could actually do that if she... Okay.
Yeah. And then John would be, trying to think of the math here, like 33 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So Laverne is taken to a holding cell. And as soon as the metal door shut, Laverne thought, shit, I screwed up.
You think, Laverne?
She recanted her confession. She said she made it up and just wanted to get out of that bad relationship with John. The officers didn't buy it. She's like, okay, well, I'll go to trial. She pleads not guilty for murder. The jury also didn't buy it. And so she gets guilty and is sentenced to life in prison. John saw how it went for her, and he was scared that he would get the death penalty. So instead of pleading not guilty, he pled no contest. Which, if you don't know what that means, it basically means he accepted the conviction, but he did not plead or admit guilt. Even though he wrote a guilty letter eventually, but whatever. And that's that. Horrible, tragic case. But for the most part, pretty clean cut, right?
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, well, I forgot to mention.
Oh, no.
In Portland, Oregon, on a bathroom stall, there was a really strange note that was found, written on the bathroom stall. It read, quote, I killed Tanya Bennett on January 21st, 1990 in Portland, Oregon. I beat her to death, raped her, and loved it. Yes, I'm sick, but I enjoy myself, too. People took the blame, and I'm free.
Is this like a bathroom of a bar, or?
No, it's of a truck stop.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's weird, right? But what are you going to do? Who did this come from? What can you make of it? Then a second note was discovered on a bathroom stall.
Another truck stop?
Mm-hmm. And this one was in Livingston, Montana. And it read, quote, kill Tanya Bennett in Portland. Two people got the blame so I can kill again. okay, two strikes, but again, what's to be done about this? And then the local newspaper, the Oregonian, so like
I love that.
I know, I'm like trying to say it, the Oregon newspaper basically, gets a letter from an anonymous source in May 1994. Now, this was a 5-page letter, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I will read part of the 5th page of the letter. So in the header area, it says all 5 of 5, and to the left of it, there's a large smiley face at the top, and it had like 2 skinny vertical ovals and just like a big old smiley.
Right.
So it says, quote, I would like to tell my story. I'm a good person at times. I always wanted to be liked. I've been married and divorced with children. I didn't really want to be married, but it happened. I read your paper. I know.
You would have to propose or accept. Whatever. Okay, keep going.
Okay. I have read your paper and enjoyed it a lot. I always wanted to be noticed like Paul Harvey, front page, etc. So I started something I don't know how to stop. On or around January 20th, 1990, I picked up Tanya Bennett and took her home. I raped her and beat her real bad. Her face was all broke up. Then I ended her life by pushing my fist into her throat. It turned me on.
Oh my gosh.
I got high. Then panic set in. Where to put the body? I drove out to the Sandy River and threw her purse and Walkman away and drove the scenic route and past the falls. I went back home and dragged her to the car. I want you to know that it was my crime. God will be the judge when I die. I'm telling you this because I will be responsible for these crimes. No one else. But I will not turn myself in. I am not stupid.
But I'm going to write this letter.
You sound okay. Pretty fucking stupid to me.
Someone else already took the blame. Just sit and chill.
Exactly. But, you know, they can't ever do that. They have to know that it's his chill.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, 3 strikes. But what do you do with that information? They try to match the fingerprints in their database from the envelope, but they got nothing. And DNA technology wasn't great back then. And they already had 2 people that confessed that were literally in prison. So really, they just let this note go. Until 5 years later. Keith Jesperson lived with his on-again, off-again girlfriend in a small ranch one-story house at 18434 North Everett Street in downtown Portland. At this time, his girlfriend was in the off-again phase, as she recently ran off to Tennessee with a trucker.
Okay.
Sounds like a stable relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was bored on this fine Sunday afternoon, so he decided to go play pool at the local BNI Tavern, only a few blocks away from his house, being downtown and all. He walked into the tavern when he was immediately greeted by this young woman running up to him and giving him a hug. It was Tanya.
Oh.
Even though he was kind of taken off guard, but at the same time, he was 34 years old, and he was a big guy. He's 6'6" and 250 pounds. And this young 23-year-old was hugging him. So, according to him, this was short-lived, as she was very pushy about him buying her a drink. So he got annoyed and left, and he was like, I'm just not doing this today. Like, I'm annoyed. He went home, he made some coffee and took a shower, and he was really just bored again. And we'll get into this a little bit more in a bit, but he's sitting there and he's just getting angrier and angrier about being hit on by this girl and then being duped. Just kind of like a piggy bank.
I mean, just take the compliment and go. I mean, come on.
Exactly. If you don't want to buy her a drink, don't buy her a drink.
Yep.
Well, he thinks to himself, maybe I can convince her to have a one-night stand with me if I buy her some drinks and like charm her a little bit.
Right, because that's exactly how it works.
Yeah,
you know, you buy a drink and then bam.
Totally. Vodka cranberry. Ooh, take my pants off. So he goes back to the bar around 5 p.m. And at this time, he drives there. He doesn't walk. And surprisingly, Tanya was still there and seemed a bit more boozed up than before. I mean, she had been playing pool for hours. And he's creepily watching her from the bar. And she's standing by herself, digging through her purse. And she finally walks out and he follows her. She walks to another nearby restaurant and tries pulling on the handles, but it's locked. And he sneaks up behind her and says, I don't have money on me to take you to a restaurant, but come with me to my house and I'll get some more money. And she kind of just stares at him and doesn't say anything. And he says, oh, do you remember me? You hugged me earlier at the bar this afternoon. And she was like, oh, yeah, I remember you, but nah, I'm good.
Good job, Tanya.
But Keith saw a vulnerability in her. He knew that she was hungry, and he figured that she wanted to keep drinking. So he says, okay, look, we'll go eat, and then we'll go somewhere else and play pool. We won't go to my house. How about that? And she was like, yeah, okay, like, that sounds good. Like, the vulnerability worked. So they get in the car, and naturally, he drives straight to his house.
Yep.
He turns off the car and says, "Why don't you come in for a moment until I find my money?" And although apprehensive, they were already at the house. So she agrees, and she puts her purse and Walkman on the floor. Entering the house, Jesperson acts like he's going to go into the other room, but he just stares at her from the hallway as she enters the kitchen. And he's like, time to make a move. So as she was looking at a literal picture of Jesus on the wall, he comes up behind her and hugs her waist, pushing his ruddy, manly parts against her, thinking that she would think that this was a turn on.
Yeah, okay.
When do we ever think that's a turn on? No. So she recoils and pulled away, not wanting to, you know, get busy with his manly parts. And he bluntly asked her, "I guess sex is out of the question too."
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. So obviously he just saw her as an object, and she just kind of like looks at him and like starts walking towards the door, like to get away.
Right.
And Jesperson describes the situation, which this is completely gross, but that she's a fly and he's a spider. He's a 250-pound man and she's like this little girl.
That's disgusting.
I know. And she can't possibly think that she could get away from him. So he wasn't aggressive about it, but he like grabbed her arm and like led her to the bed. Like he didn't like throw her.
Right.
He was like leading her to the bed. And which was, by the way, in the middle of the living room. So you can see how much his life is together.
I no words. There's literally no words.
Yeah. So he tries to kiss her again and again, she pulls away and all of a sudden she huffs and she just says, "Hurry up and get it over with."
Wow.
Which is horrific. But this, again, we'll get into it in a bit, brought back some not so great memories from his ex-wife.
I'm sure.
If you can imagine. Immediately, he remembered feelings of shame, embarrassment, anger, and he was triggered. He got on top of her and he straddled her, holding her down. He stared at her. The longer he stared, the angrier he got. And at this point, since he's holding her down, he's holding her against her will. If she goes to the cops, that's immediate prison time. So he thinks to himself, "I've never hit a woman before, but how hard could it be to slug her in the face and knock her out, carry her to the car, and leave her someplace?" Making a fist, he cocked his arms back and punched her as hard as he could. Blood splattered everywhere on his face, clothes, the mattress, the floors, walls, even the TV. He hit her again and again and again until he says he went into a blackout rage and had no control over himself. Which, it's funny, because that's what always happens.
That's what I say, everyone has a blackout rage, where they woke up and then there's blood on their hands.
Exactly. What happened? When the rage was over, Bennett was unrecognizable. He had no idea how many times he had hit her, and she stopped moving. He remembered, this is bad, he remembered what she was there for and started unbuttoning her pants and unzipping him. And then he claims that he stopped and he couldn't let himself do it, which, how fucking noble of you.
Yeah, after you beat her to a pulp. Great.
Exactly. Thanks. Exactly. To make sure that she was dead, he was like looking at her bottom area and he basically was looking like for signs of death, which is like a stream of urine.
Right.
And it came. And so now he's like, "Now I have to make extra sure that she's dead," aka overkill, aka why she was basically unrecognizable. He got up and went to the garage and found a length of nylon rope. Using a knife from the kitchen, he severed the ends to keep a short knot and basically tied it around her neck. And then he remembered, shit, I touched her jeans and put my fingerprints on her button zipper area. So he took the knife and cut out the area of the button fly area.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm, before placing the material in his pocket. So panic started setting in. What am I going to do? He thought, then jumped as the telephone rang. It was his on and again, off again girlfriend, Pamela. His heart sank. Was she down the street? Was she calling to see if he needed her to pick up anything on the way home? And she was in Knoxville, to his relief, Knoxville, Tennessee. Soon, she became his on again girlfriend. She said that she loved him. She wanted to come home. And as he's saying this, he looks around and realizes there's still blood and a dead girl on my mattress. Again, he says, what am I going to do? I have to set up an alibi. I have to make sure that the bartender saw me leave the bar alone. So, with a dead girl sitting on his mattress, he grabs his keys and drives back to the tavern for the third time that day.
He wasn't like covered in blood or anything?
Apparently not. Okay. Or I'm not sure if he showered. That's a very good point. I'm not sure if he showered and changed clothes or anything, but he went back to the bar. So he wanted to make himself seen by other patrons. So he shouted at the bartender, "Hey, can I get a beer over here?" And she gives him a look like, "Don't scream at me." And she gives him a beer. So while he's drinking the beer, he's thinking about where to put Tanya. He thought about the Vista House Monument by the Columbia River Gorge. He had been hiking out there several times, and he knew the area really well. And there was also a dense forest there that he could place her. The bartender asks if he wants another, and he responds, "No, I just wanted to say goodnight."
That's creepy.
And she's like, "Yeah, sure, man." But she was probably thinking, "You fucking weirdo. Like,
right.
Please go home." So he drives to the area and scopes it out, make sure it was secluded, and it was. And on his way home, he stopped at an open all-night mini mart to make sure that his tail lights were working, to avoiding getting pulled over. He also turned off his dome light, so when he opened the door, the light wanted to turn on. Like, he's taking all these, like, minor steps.
I was going to say, someone's watched a couple true crime documentaries.
Somebody's watched the first 48.
Right.
So it's 12:30 a.m. now. He heads back and drags her out the door. Her pants fall down since he cut her zipper area, which is why he says her pants were down when they found her. He drove back to the area, and it's still pitch black, and he dragged her by the arms, heading deep in. And this area was slippery, and I feel like this is a little bit, you know, made up, but he said that it was an 85-foot drop that they fell. I'm like, I feel like that would...
Kill
you.
Yeah, there's no way.
So I don't think it's an 85-foot drop, but they slipped and they dropped, and she got in an area, and he's like, "I had to, like, put her there because I couldn't move her anymore."
Right.
So he covered her with leaves and sticks, and there she was, one arm over the top of her head, pants around her ankles, rope around her neck, and her face was beaten in. In the late hours of the night, Keith would drive and throw Tanya's Walkman and shoes out the window. He pulled over to the side of the road and hid her purse and wallet in a nearby wooded area. And he watched the sunrise come up at a breakfast cafe, had a few cups of coffee, and even chatted with a couple of state troopers, just saying, "Good morning, officers."
So obviously no remorse whatsoever.
No remorse whatsoever. And that's the story of how Tanya Bennett really died. But again, nobody would actually know this for 5 years. So, again, we are talking about Keith Jesperson, a.k.a. the Happy Face Killer. And he got that nickname just because he put the smiley face on the, or the happy face on the top of the letter. Now, before we dive into this, I just want to say that I read a book called Dangerous Ground by M. William Phelps. And in this book, he sits down and he talks with Happy Face over the span of, I think, 5 years total, which this guy, like, had to go through, like, immense amount of, like, therapy. He had diverticulitis.
Oh, my gosh.
And he had to have surgery. Like, this was a stressful situation for him.
Yeah.
It was nuts. But a lot of the things that I'm going to say are from Keith Jesperson himself. So they could be true and they could be bullshit. But, you know, just take it with a grain of salt. Like, some of the details that I say.
Okay.
So let's get into Keith's childhood. A not-so-fun fact, a psychopath is said to be born every 47 seconds compared to 250 births per minute. So almost one per minute, or 0.004% of the population.
That's insane.
Yeah. Keith was born on April 6th, 1955, to Leslie, which he went by Les, that was his father, and Gladys Jesperson in Chilliwack, British Columbia. He was the middle child of two brothers, Bruce and Brad, and two sisters, Sharon and Jill. And I'm not going to go into it, but there are claims that he used to abuse animals as a child, as young as when he was 5 years old. He had a chocolate lab growing up named Duke, which he did not abuse. This was his best friend. They went fishing, hunting, took walks, and slept together. Around 10 years old, he was friends with a boy named Martin, and the two would often get into trouble together. Jesperson claimed that he was punished many times for things that Martin had done, and he actually got the blame for it. This led Jesperson to attack Martin, violently beating him until his father pulled him away.
Wow.
And he said that his intentions were to kill him at 10 years old. Approximately a year later, Jesperson was swimming in a lake when he held another boy underwater and attempted to make him go unconscious and to drown him. And he later said that, like, "I was going to drown him if the lifeguard didn't get him off me."
Okay, red flags. Mm-hmm. Keep going.
So the real, I think, pain in his childhood comes from his father. I mean, obviously, he's awful at this point anyway, but I think his father had, like, a lot to do with his anger. He served in the Canadian Merchant Navy, so his father was strict from having a military background. And although he gave the community the impression that he was a simple outdoorsman who loved nothing more than riding his four-wheeler, running businesses, being a loving grandfather, and everything like that, he was abusive emotionally, physically, and yeah, he was just bad. So he would beat his kids with a belt, what felt like every day. He said that he was his father's whipping post. His father would constantly say to him as a child, you're nothing but a piece of shit on a stick. When he was young, his father put the blame on him for everything that went wrong. There was one time they were working on a farm together, and his dad actually put a backhoe through a siding of a house, which I don't even know how you do that.
Yeah.
But he blamed his kid. There was another instance where his father had accused him of taking his cigarettes, and he said no, and he said, don't lie to me. And then he found the cigarettes, and as a punishment for quote-unquote hiding them, he made Keith smoke one, and he was like just like taking like little puffs of it, and his dad was like, no, I want you to inhale it.
Father of the year.
Father of the year. Duke, his lab, his best friend, was shot by his dad because he thought that he, quote, got into some poison and he was dragging around and didn't look good, so he put him out of his misery. Eventually, he said he didn't respect his dad. He feared him. Les told Keith that religion and God were there for him if he chose that down the road, but if for as long as he lived under his roof, it would not be welcomed.
Okay.
Les would do anything to keep the Jesperson name from tarnishing, and Keith actually said later in life that, quote, I actually believe that I killed and continue to do these crimes, and in my mind while I'm doing this, I'm tearing down the Jesperson family name. Later in life, Les apparently drunkenly confessed to killing a man once on a drunk hit and run, and he was never caught for that. So that's just a little bit about his father.
Right, and how he grew up.
Right. At some point in his childhood, they moved to the United States to Washington. Keith said that he had a hard time fitting in there, and he would actually be called Igor at his school because of his size.
Aww.
I know. He's a big boy. There was a rival between his brother Brad and himself. They were always going neck and neck at each other. They did not get along. Brad was always the good son who could do no wrong in his father's eye. Essentially, he was his favorite. So there was an instance where there was a hazing platoon at school, and Brad was part of it. And basically, like, he was trying to pull down Jesperson's pants, mm-hmm. like, in front of everybody else. And, like, there was a big old fight, big old brawl. And then he gave his brother a black eye. And they go home, and Brad's like, if he would have just, like, cooperated with the hazing, like, he would have been fine.
Right.
And then his father was like, oh, well, yeah, you're right. Why didn't he just cooperate?
Why didn't he let someone haze you?
Why didn't you just, like, show your privates to everybody? He was in wrestling in high school and couldn't reach the top of the rope in practice. So again, he was even teased more for being Igor, and he couldn't reach the top. He tried and tried, and one day the rope pulled or broke on him, and he fell 25 feet hitting his head on the hard gym floor.
Ooh.
So I just want to point out.
Brain injury.
That there's a head injury right there. He graduated high school, and he was ranked 161 with an IQ of 102, and he meets a woman named Rose Pernick. Rose would eventually become his wife on August 2nd, 1975, and they would have three children together. And I know you're shocked by this, but the marriage wasn't great.
What?
They argued all the time, and apparently they weren't very intimate with each other.
I gotta drink a water. I feel like I'm getting raspy.
They argued all the time and apparently weren't very intimate with each other. There were times that Rose would tell him to, quote, go stick his dick in a keyhole when he made a move on her. And he was forced to masturbate angrily and hire prostitutes because of this.
Okay.
So, he was forced to do that. Mm-hmm. And I know you're extra shocked by this, but they were divorced by April of 1989. He said that after this, he started spiraling. He said, quote, I wasn't seeing my kids. I was just creating a bad situation around me, and I was getting angrier and angrier at the fact that I'm still here. I'm working. I'm continuing to work, and every time I try to work a little harder and push forward, I'm being pushed back. But at the same time, this douchebag also said, when I was got divorced and we were in court, I looked at my kids and they saw that they were in pain. But here's the thing. It made me feel warm inside to know that I was responsible for that pain. I was actually happy that they were suffering and would continue to suffer from the divorce.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
His own children?
So he is the most flippy floppy person.
I was like, even Albert Fish like respected his own children.
Exactly. He's not that, and that's something. So, like I said, take this with a grain of salt. He goes to truck driving school, or whatever that's called, because he wants to be a semi-truck driver. Tanya's murder happens, but again, him and Pamela are back together in their little ranch house, and Keith is sitting there like there wasn't a brutal murder that just happened in this house days prior, while casually, you know, just chilling there and observing his surrounding, the news comes on, and the anchor of the news announces that two people, a couple in fact, have been arrested for the murder of Tanya Bennett. Their names were Laverne and John, and they had admitted to the murder. And Keith's jaw dropped to the floor.
Yeah, I bet he's happy.
He said, "What? I'm so confused." And then his surprise turned into excitement, thinking, "I just got away with this. I can keep getting away with this." And that is where we are going to end part one.
No!
Don't worry, you'll hear it soon, because, surprise again, we are recording two episodes at one time.
Yep, so we will hopefully release them really quickly, too, depending on how this week goes.
I think we will.
Yeah.
I have faith in us.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening.
And make sure you follow our Instagram, Colts, Killers, and Cocktails. And if you have any case suggestions, just send us a DM.
Yep, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.